We had the pleasure of sitting down with Matt Petrick. He's an award-winning rum and cocktail writer, consultant, and historian. Listen to the podcast and you'll get his passion for rum, cocktails, especially tiki cocktails. Be sure to reach out to Matt and let him know what you thought about the podcast. Cheers! Ladies and gentlemen, craft spirit enthusiasts, and those interested in the intoxicating world of craft distilleries, cideries, meaderies, wineries, and the occasional foray into breweries. It's Rich Shane, and welcome to Fermented Adventure, the podcast, where we bring you the fascinating people that are making the mash, fermenting, distilling, bottling, pouring, and delivering to you some of the finest libations in the world. Before we get started, here are a few housekeeping items. Thank you for bringing the podcast into wherever you are and whatever you're doing. We truly are grateful that you have chosen to listen and make us part of your day. It would mean the world to us if you left a 5-star review. This helps us climb in the rankings and it makes it easier for others to find us. Don't hesitate to leave us your comments as well. If the podcast didn't meet your expectations, tell us why. We're always striving to improve. You can find us at fermentedadventure.com. We are on Instagram and Facebook as Fermented Adventure. Email us at fermentedadventure@gmail.com. All right, FA Nation, let's meet our guests. We're here at Tales of the Cocktail. I'm with Matt Petrick. And Matt, you're an author, you're an educator, you're a rum wonk, you're a cocktail wonk. How did all that get started for you?
So it started based upon a love of tiki cocktails back 15 years ago. And the more I learned about it, the more excited I got. And my wife told me at one point, like, honey, I love you. You need to go tell somebody else. And I had previously been a writer on things about Microsoft Windows. So I had some experience in writing. And I was like, you're right. I should be telling other people about this stuff. So I started writing the Cocktail Wonk blog. And it all sort of evolved downhill from there, or uphill, depending on how you want to put it.
Dawn and I love tiki cocktails. We love going to tiki bars. And it's something newer for us. Through your journey, how did you discover, like, what was it about tiki bars for you or the tiki cocktail experience?
So I've loved the flavor, the exotic fruits, the syrups, the balance of sweet and sour, the rums, the rummy taste. I think at one point, you know, decades ago, I had a proper Mai Tai made with orgeat, and that flavor just sort of pulled me in. Like, I need to know more about this. And it sort of laid dormant for several decades. And then when we had a house in Seattle, we were renovating it. We had to move out. And when we were living in an apartment, my wife gave me Beach Bum Berry's, his Sip and Safari book. And that was sort of like, it clicked. All of a sudden, I'm like, oh. This is the information I need to start going down that rabbit hole. And when I did it, it was just – when I started reading it, it was just, I want to make these cocktails. But that within a year or so, it was like, I want to know more. I'm going to do my own research and learn more about it. So,
with that love and passion of those tiki cocktails, I'm sure you have some people you've met along the way, some experiences. What are some of those standout experiences or people you've met along the way through your love and passion?
Oh man, that's hard to list. You know, I'm fundamentally a geek, and I love, or a wonk, if you will, and I love meeting people who are similarly wonky about things. So meeting Jeff Barry. We live in the same town now. Jeff Barry and David Wondrich, who's not necessarily a tiki guy, but sort of the spirits guru, the ultimate researcher on all things cocktails and spirits, and Martin Cade of Smuggler's Cove and his passion for rum, and just also very passionate bartenders that have sort of taken their love and like left their jobs, taken their love for tiki and built bars. So I've been very fortunate to be able to travel the world. I'm willing to travel more, travel the world and go places that I would not ordinarily have. You know, one standout experience is we went to Three Dots and a Dash in Chicago once.
We've been there, and it's one of our favorites.
Yeah, it is. It's a great bar, but we were there. You know, we didn't tell anybody we were coming. But Kevin Berry spotted me from across the bar, pulled me, and basically he's like, "You're Matt Puchek?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Come on in back." And suddenly, like, me and my wife and our good friend Ed Rudisell from Inferno Room, suddenly we're behind the scenes at Three Dots and a Dash. And over the next 3 hours, the entire menu of cocktails was served to us while we're watching them being made in the back. So that's like one example of a cool experience.
That is a really cool experience. And I guess in a world where everybody is saying, well, keep going on that journey, do more, has it ever crossed your mind to open up your own tiki restaurant, tiki cocktail bar?
I will say flat out no, because I know so many, I have so many friends who own cocktail bars and they love it and they're passionate about it, but they're like, it's brutal. It's hard. You know, the profit margins are thin. They're working 18-hour days. I love to do what I do. I love to research and write and explain. I don't want to run a restaurant.
Matt, you've said the word wonk a couple of times.
Right.
What's a wonk?
So I'm of a certain age where if you were around for like the Clintons, you know, Bill Clinton early on in his when he was sort of ascending, you know, to the presidency, was called a policy wonk. So it's somebody who loves the details, who you can't go, you can't get them to say, "I've done, I don't care anymore." Like they want to learn everything, know everything, and talk about it all the time with everybody.
I feel like as we were coming to Tales and we had the opportunity to meet you, I felt like I was going to go on this journey with this knowledge. You're a knowledgeable tour guide. If I said I want somebody to guide me through rum and tiki cocktails, Matt, you're the one I want to have, you know, take us to those little nuanced places, the hidden gems. What are some of those tiki bars or places that you say, hey, these are my favorites. Anytime we're in a city, this is where we have to go.
Okay. So I mean, the two examples that come to mind are actually the two examples that sort of led me to write our book, Minimalist Tiki. We lived in Seattle at the time. First bar would be Rumba, which is not a tiki bar per se, but it is a rum bar. It has an amazing collection of rums. And their bartenders are well-versed in tropical tiki cocktails. So even though they're not over the top with the tiki decor, at their heart, they make some of the best tropical drinks I've ever had. And I was there so often that people thought I was an owner of the bar. Another example is to the south of there, Tacoma. My good friend Jason Alexander, who owned the Tacoma Cabana and later became Devil's Reef. Jason is just the most passionate person I know about tropical cocktails. He's always inventing new recipes. He's always finding an interesting twist on something. And it's never this crazy stuff where you need like fermented eye of newt or anything like that. He manages to take readily accessible drinks or ingredients and create new and innovative recipes. And I love what he was doing, and I was like, he's not getting the attention he should. And started with him, and I realized that there are other bartenders out there who are doing great tiki recipes, great work, and just aren't getting the attention. You know, people would always go to the same two or three top best known tiki people to get their thoughts, and these other bartenders just weren't getting the same love and attention. And so that's what led me to realize we needed to write a book that, among other things, included these other bartenders and their recipes to sort of put the spotlight on them.
If it weren't for the rum, for the most part, you wouldn't have a great tiki cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
And you really have this sense about rum, this desire to tell the history, to experience rum. And I think there's a romanticism about rum. When I say rum to you, what do you think about?
Oh, I think about all the many different flavors that are out there, the different styles of rum, the just the fact that it's not one spirit. It's not like bourbon, where like all bourbons have somewhat of a similar profile. It's a much more wildly diverse category of different flavors. And I love all the different styles of rum, but something like a Jamaican rum, people have never had Jamaican rum might ask like, what is this funk? Everybody talks about funk, but like we don't and my answer is once you taste it, you will know it. There's just something I did an interview once and I said, when you first experience funk, there's like something like the back of your brain that says like, this is what rum is. This is why it's unique. This is why it's so beloved in tropical cocktails. And a little bit of you goes like, is this safe to drink? Because it's just a little more primal than, you know, a more refined spirit.
Would you equate the funk in rum to peat in scotch?
That's a great analogy that a lot of people use. I would say that the flavors are very different. But if you look at it from the context of, is this something that's sort of like very strong and very polarizing, and you either love it or you hate it? Yes, funk is like that. My wife does not love high-ho-go Jamaican rums, and she does not like peaty whiskey, peaty scotches. But again, I'm not saying they taste the same, but they have that same immediate, like, very strong, unique flavor be above and beyond just the regular flavors you'd expect. So, like, I think of scotch whiskey as, like, there's a scotch base, but then peat is sort of like this whole other thing on the side of it. And the same with rum. Like, rum has this base flavor, but funkiness is a whole other thing added onto the side of it.
Where you look out to the landscape of rum right now, and you're trying new rums all the time, I'm sure. Where does craft fit into the whole sector? And what's your experience with more craft rum, these smaller distilleries creating these rums today?
So it's an interesting question. A related question is like, what is American rum? Same basic question. And it's hard to answer because there's no sort of, they're not yet. They're all so new, or most of them are so new, that they haven't developed a unique, readily identifiable style yet. And if they have, they're maybe wildly different from somebody else's style. So, you know, the Kohana rum from Hawaii is a cane juice style rum, which will be very different from the sort of weird, funky stuff made at Rulison here in New Orleans, or the Privateer rum, which is up in Massachusetts, which is going to come across, you know, work very well for bourbon drinkers. It tastes almost like a Barbados rum. So it's really hard to define to define what an American style rum is. And to that point as well, it's because there's so many small distilleries who are just starting to experiment with rum. And some of those distilleries they're not doing just rum. Some, you know, you see a lot of distilleries who are doing, oh, let's do a bourbon, let's do a gin, let's do a rum, let's do a whatever. And they're not focusing on rum. And I think it's a challenge for them to you know, make something unique, because they don't have the time to devote the time and the resources to just keep making rum over and over again and experimenting to create their own signature style. There are a few American distilleries have been around long enough where they have sort of figured out, this is what we want to do. We're focusing on rum. We're not screwing around with making gins or other things like that. And they have developed a style that's readily identifiable, and I approve of that. I think it's great. You know, I still think, you know, a lot of them have a long way to go before they will be, you know, can go head to head with the great legendary distilleries of the Caribbean, like Mount Gay or Appleton or Angostura, for example.
You know, you said a number of things that stood out to me there. As far as developing a signature style and focusing on, if you want to be known for rum, then it's got to be something you really spend time and effort. I think it becomes that identity, right? Whereas these distilleries, as you mentioned, Mount Gay, and, you know, they've honed it. That's all they do.
Right.
And I think for the consumer, for me and Dawn and you, you kind of want to still let them be that rum, those rum pirates, right? Let them do that without putting restrictions on. Because once, I think you said use the term American style rum. I don't know if we really want to start putting constraints on people. We don't want to be putting constraints on people on how they're producing rum. To be American, you have to use these specific ingredients or this specific process or this way of doing it, because let's let everybody do it. But you have to create an identity. And I think that's what's those standout distilleries that you talk about. That's what they've done.
Yeah, right. And it's It's we don't it, you know, rum is what it wants to be, but it's also at the end of the day, it has to taste good. It has to be something, you know, a good rum has to have a well defined character to it, and it's challenging for small craft distilleries to sort of have the technique, have to learn the techniques, learn the tradition, have the aging capability to make something like the big old, you know, the legendary distilleries. You know, the whole thing with craft is people will sort of emphasize craft, and it's great that people are doing it, but I will say the reason the big guys, you know, in all the spirits, the reason the big guys are big is because they've done that for a long time. So they know it very well. They know the business well, and they can make a great product. And, you know, it's my hope that some of these craft distilleries will themselves grow into that over the decades.
So you're an author. You're writing these wonderful experiences about cocktails and tikis, and now you're writing about Caribbean-style rum. I'm just curious, you know, you have this passion, you have this desire to tell your story. What's the process for you to create these books to just, I think what you want to do is, I think again, for me and Dawn, what you're doing today is you're taking us on a little bit of a journey. This is our fermented adventure. What's the process or what's your desire to help people come along your adventure with you?
So it's somebody once told me that like every person has a superpower. They have something that they're uniquely good at. And just over time, I sort of realized my superpower is to take something complicated, you know, and maybe filled with like mysticism or whatever, or it's a secret, and say like, no, I want to understand that. And somebody is making this thing so I can understand it. And to just dig in until I find the answer. And so, you know, almost all of my writing comes from that desire to take a problem or take something that's mysterious and just sort of say, it's not mysterious. If we look at it logically, analytically, we can understand it. And if we can understand it, we can appreciate it more. And so, you know, a lot of, you know, I think of it in computer science terms. I always have a background thread in my brain. No matter what I'm doing, there's this background thread of like, what caught my interest? Or somebody said something, now I'm intrigued. Or I realize I don't know something. There's always this background thread that's sort of processing like what's interesting to me, and I just let it go. And at some point, it sort of forms a nucleus of, oh, this is something I want to address. So for in the case of the modern Caribbean rum, it was there are books out there about rum, but many of them are primarily focused on what does this rum taste like? And I'm like, that's lots of people could do that, and that's great, but nobody's really done the work to sort of thoroughly explain all the parts of making rum, from not only the source material, but the fermentation, distillation, aging, blending process. And then nobody's explained the business side of rum, like the many brands don't make their own rum. They buy from blenders, and nothing wrong with that. There's some great rum, but people need to understand that. If we really want to appreciate the whole category, you need to understand that. And then there's this whole, all the distilleries, like dozens of distilleries in the Caribbean, and most people will never make it to them. And if that's the case, I want to try to bring that to them. So I want to give people the most, I realized I wanted to give people the most comprehensive, but readable and understandable picture of Caribbean rum that I could. And that vision came to me in 2016, and it took me 7 years from that point to basically make it into what became modern Caribbean rum. But I always knew that would happen. Like that was my white whale that I chased for 7 years.
Through the process of all the research and discovery, are there some things that were like those aha, wow in your face when you learn something? The pen or the fingers on the keyboard couldn't write fast enough to explain that story?
So, yeah, there's a bunch of things came, you know, in writing Modern Caribbean Rum. Things, you know, I'm very much of a person who is a fan of original sources. Like, you know, I may have read an article that says blah, 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 but that article got their information from somewhere. So I always want to go go find the original sources, see what was written about this in 1850, for example. And so a number of things that I thought I knew, you know, for example, to give one example, is, you know, today we like these cocktail recipes like the Mai Tai. It says, oh, and, you know, the Trader Vic's second suggested Mai Tai recipe was Martinique rum. And so we think, oh, that must be rum agricole. That must be a cane juice rum. But I was like, wait a minute. You know, in my research, in sort of researching the Martinique chapter of the book of Modern Caribbean Rum, I realized, wait, the records here show that really no agricole was being exported. That agricole was consumed locally. What was being shipped off Martinique was molasses rum. So a very different style of rum. And there was that aha moment of, wait, all these people are trying to recreate classic cocktails following directions exactly as written without realizing that something fundamentally had changed from now versus, you know, 60 years ago when these recipes were being made. So those are the sort of like discoveries that I made that I would like, that was a particular joy in this book of like, you thought you knew this, but you didn't. Here's the real story.
I love watching your face light up. I wish like right now you and I were just drinking a little bit of rum and feeling the essence of all those flavors, even a Mai Tai. We need to have a Mai Tai and do this.
Yes.
Pardon the interruption. Thank you so much for listening to Fermented Adventure, the podcast. Could you do us a favor? Hit that follow button. It makes it easier for others to find us, and it helps us climb in the rankings. Take a screenshot of the podcast, post it, tag us, and let everyone know that you listen to the Fermented Adventure podcast. Now, back to our podcast.
When we talk about this modern Caribbean rum, this modern Caribbean style, again, talk about what you think that characteristic is, or what you really want to have readers understand from your perspective.
So I don't really feel there is a specific Caribbean style. I think of it as a family of different styles. Depends on how you want to break things apart. But you know, you could say there's like 80 different styles around. But I think of them the way I think of them is there are, you know, some, you know, in the simplest possible breakdown, I think there are rums that are what I call fermentation forward. Like these rums get their flavor from the fermentation process, that they didn't have to spend a moment in a barrel and they're still incredibly flavorful. And those are things like the Jamaican rums. Like you go buy Ray and Nephew Overproof, for example, or any of the Jamaican Overproof, unaged Jamaican Overproof rum, they are packed with flavor. They dominate the palate. Most people are like, who taste it for the first time, they're like, they can't handle it. It's so strong. So there are these fermentation-forward rums, and then there's this other style that I call aging-forward rums. These are the rums that maybe don't have a huge amount of flavor from fermentation, but they get more of their flavor from the aging and the blending process. So we think about things like the Cuban-style rums, or Puerto Rico, for example. These are the rums that are not aged for a very long time, like packed with flavors if you drank it straight off the still. But after 5-10 years in a barrel, it has those lovely aromas and flavors that we associate with that style. So, and we could go subdivide that further and further, but you know, there is no, like I said, there's no one canonical Caribbean rum style. It's like I said, it's a family of different styles.
Where can people find your book?
On our website. So there is sort of our publishing website. We run Wonk Press. We publish multiple different books, including Modern Caribbean Rum and Minimalist Tiki. That would be wonkpress.com. And then there's also, we have a dedicated site for the rum book, Modern Caribbean Rum, as well.
I'm going to put you on the spot.
Yes.
You're only allowed to take 4 bottles. We're going to do a Mount Rushmore of rum bottles. You're going away to that island.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming you're going to take your wife.
Mm-hmm.
So yes. You need to make sure there's enough for both of you.
Yes.
What 4 bottles at Mount Rushmore of rum on that deserted island are you going to be taking with you?
Oh, that's a great question. Because normally I get asked, what's your favorite rum? And then like, well, what's your favorite child? But you say 4, now I have to think hard. I would certainly take a Jamaican style rum that's not super funky and well aged, but not extremely long aged. I'm thinking about like the ITP mark. So there's several different bottles out there, Long Pond ITP. The particular mark made at Long Pond aged for 10 to 15 years. That is just, there's something, it's just perfect blend of fermentation flavors and aging flavors. So that would be one. Number two, I would certainly take a heavier style Cuban rum. And not only do I love it, but my wife loves it. So that's her rum. When I say, like, I bought a bottle of Cuban rum, she's like, oh, thank you, it's for me. Good Cuban style rum. So like Selection de Maestros from Cavana Club or Eminente, the longer aged Eminentes, new ones coming out soon. Then probably, you know, because you got to represent the King's U style. So maybe something Martinique Rum Agricole AOC, some sort of, you know, 5 to 10 year aged King's U style rum. And the fourth, that's a hard one. They got one slot left for so much stuff I love. Maybe something like Angostura 1787, which is a sort of, you know, it's a Spanish heritage style rum, but it is so much deeper, darker, and more complex than what people think about when they think about Spanish style rum. Something with a little heft and a little body to it that I can just pour it in a snifter and just drink it all night.
You know, I was thinking about the character or the criteria of the way I worded that.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, all right, if I said to you, your house is on fire, God forbid, and you can only pick, you only save four bottles, you know, which ones are you saving?
Right.
But I think those would still be the bottles
I mean, it's funny because you're like, which bottles are worth the most? And which ones are like, would I actually, you know, grab? You know, it's a good question.
Where do you see the modern rum? Is there a direction you see things going? Is there a direction you'd like to see it go?
Yeah, so what we're seeing with modern rum is a sort of two big trends. Number one is essentially the eco aspect of it. There, that, you know, making any distilled spirit fundamentally creates waste and pollution, and we're seeing the rum industry, you know, and some great examples in the Caribbean. It's like figuring out how do we do this in ecologically sensible manner, where we're not polluting rivers, we're not putting, you know, materials into the air, and we've made some fantastic strides there. The other large trend I'm seeing is that in the old days, 30, 40, 50 years ago, you could, like, a rum maker would use molasses and they could just, like, call up a molasses broker and good quality molasses would arrive and it would be inexpensive. Countries like Guyana could supply most of the molasses needed by all the Caribbean distillers. But in the last couple decades, global warming and demand for molasses from other industries, like cattle farming, for example, is sort of like making it harder to get molasses, harder to get the molasses reliably and inexpensively enough. And so we're seeing a lot of rum companies taking control of their source material supply chain, that they can't just, like, hope that there's molasses to buy somewhere. They're either a lot of new distilleries are saying, we're just going with cane juice directly. We're going to own sugar cane fields. We're going to cut that cane and use that cane juice directly to make rum. And it's much more efficient because you can make six times the amount of rum if you do it from cane juice than if you take that sugar cane, turn it into molasses and sugar crystals that you sell somewhere else. So you can just make much more rum if you have your own cane fields. And even if they're not using cane juice, having their own cane fields, maybe their long-term supply contracts with farmers. They basically, the rum industry has hit that point where they can't rely on their source material. So they're essentially having to control more of it, own more of it. And we've sort of seen this already on the other end, like Scotch whiskey, for example. You know, the barley that you know, a big Scotch whiskey distiller will be using in 5 years wasn't even planted, but they know it's going to become Scotch whiskey. And we're starting to see rum is having to go that way as well, that we can't depend on sugar commodity being always readily available unless you sort of own it yourself.
It's really fascinating, and you bring about the idea of just the resources, mm-hmm. the change in climates, mm-hmm. what wouldn't have been able to be grown here today can be grown here today. maybe down the road, it's not sustainable.
Right.
You talk to cideries and those that have orchards, and the apples that they wanted to grow 5 years ago, now they can grow.
Mm-hmm.
And the apples that they try to grow now don't work. Is there, I mean, through the conversations you're having in the rum world and these producers, are they looking forward? I mean, you're talking about controlling maybe some source, but are they actually looking forward enough to say, well, you know, that agriculture source that we once had may not be there?
Yeah, oh, very much,
you know,
so.
You're talking a 100-plus-year-old company that's been distilling off these family recipes. Mm-hmm. What's the perspective from them?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It's something most people don't think about, but because I want to understand everything about it, we have to understand what are the challenges the companies face. And yeah, we're seeing, for example, the climate change has caused like the growing season of like on a particular island, like the growing season, which might have been January to July, is now maybe like February to August, for example, and that impacts their schedules and stuff. Like you said, we're seeing, you know, it's you know, the fundamental reason molasses was used because it was cheap. It was this inexpensive byproduct of the sugar making. But now the economics have shifted to where the rum you can make from the sugar is more valuable than the sugar crystals you can make from it. And if that's the case, then it makes sense, for example, to bring back old cane lands that were known, that weren't being used. Grenada is a perfect example. Like Grenada used to make a lot of sugar 50, 60 years ago, and it basically kind of almost died off on the island. Nobody was growing sugarcane. It wasn't profitable. And then Renegade Rum comes to the island. They want to build a very new ecological conscious distillery, but they don't have any sugarcane there. And so they had to essentially restart the sugarcane industry and basically find the lands that used to be growing sugarcane and basically replow them and prepare them and bring sugarcane back. So we're seeing that more and more.
Your passion for rum is infectious. And I can certainly see where, you know, you open up a bottle and you start a conversation, you convert wonks.
Mm-hmm.
So now I can say for me, I'm a wonk. I'm a rum wonk. I want to know more. I want to pick up your book. I want to learn what you learn. Are there things that, you know, you haven't yet felt that you want? Are there things you haven't felt that you've understood yet or learned yet you want to learn more about in the rum world?
Yeah. So I'm a huge history buff. And not just like reading other people's books. Like I mentioned earlier, going back to original sources, because those will tell you a story. And unfortunately, the original sources never tell you what the entire story you're after. They tell you like a data point or two little pieces of information. And so connecting the dots, I love doing that. And one of my favorite topics is, how did we end up with all these styles today? Like how did we go from what I call primordial rum, that rum in the 1600s, where it was like clearly something else we could make money from the waste of making sugar. How did we go from that very crudely distilled, you know, nobody understood fermentation at the same level. How do we go from that to now we have very well-defined Jamaican styles or rum agricoles or Spanish heritage styles or high ester rums or multi-element. Like what caused all of this to happen? Like what changed that made this style suddenly appear out of nowhere? And it's fascinating. And I've done an enormous amount of research on it, but I still feel like I've only scratched the surface of what's out there. So I would happily just go off to a desert island with my wife and just study that. But you got to do other things. So
you do. Is there a unicorn bottle that you've been chasing that you're like, oh, if I ever, this is the one. I've heard about it. I've seen it, but I haven't found it yet.
Yeah, it's funny. For so many geeks, it would say like the Ray and Nephew 17 is that unicorn bottle. The rum that Trader Vic said was originally used in the Mai Tai. And it's not my particular unicorn. Like I know people who have, you know, who have one of the few bottles out there, but it's not my particular unicorn. I happen to love, you know, this sort of well done old school Jamaican style rum. And so I've tasted A friend sent me a sample. There's a 1941 Jamaican rum, aged for 58 years, made at Long Pond. And it was Gordon McPhail was the bottler. Gordon McPhail, 1941 Long Pond, which when I first had that sample, it was I could have bought a bottle for $1,200, and I didn't, because now it's like $5,000 or $6,000, and I've not seen it anywhere. But I've still told myself, if I ever see that bottle, I have the opportunity to buy that bottle, I will buy that bottle.
You know, you talk about something about how something, you know, look, in our world, everything escalates in price.
Right.
Where do you see, or what are your feelings about that rum secondary market? And, you know, think about, you know, where the bourbon whiskey, Scotch whiskey, Irish whiskey, not so much Irish whiskey, but these whiskeys that they create this secondary following, right, which ramps up the price. Where do you see that in the bourbon? Where do you see that in the rum world?
Yeah, good question. I get asked this a fair amount. There's an ethos in the rum community that, you know, rum should be enjoyed, and, you know, we shouldn't, you know, nobody should be buying bottles just to flip them. You know, it's the same way in some of the other, you know, other worlds as well. But I think the rum world in particular is very adamant about, like, we're not going to turn into bourbon. They don't want to turn into that, like, wildly speculative. You got to, you know, people who don't really, who don't understand what they're buying are still able to buy it and put it away on a shelf somewhere and never taste it. You sort of, there's that sadness of, like, the people who really enjoy this and appreciate it and understand it will never get to taste that. I think, I mean, it's natural that this would happen. But I think, you know, I think there's a certain amount of bemoaning that this is happening, you know, and I agree, it shouldn't happen like that. This sort of secondary craze shouldn't happen like that. But from my perspective, you know, it's a lot of that is people who don't understand. People who are doing it or people who are buying these rums don't necessarily love and appreciate it at that same level. And so they're going to find that, you know, whatever the crowd tells them, you know, whatever that's like, oh, this particular distillery, these bottlings, these are the ones they have. These are the pappies of rum, if you will. And I'm like, okay, go do that. Because there's plenty of other rums that I maybe enjoy more, and I could still buy it, you know, at retail price. And I'm like, go chase after that one little thing, the trendy thing. There's so much more out there that you guys are ignoring because you're chasing the trendy. Like, I'm not worried about ever, like, not being able to get rums I enjoy.
What's enjoyable for me is you distill down this rum world and you create this desire to know more for me. And hopefully you'll provide this with your research and the books you write and your web presence, that you create new raving fans of rum. Because I think what happens is we all get sometimes pigeonholed. Oh, I'm only a whiskey person, or I'm only a vodka person, but experience the whole plethora of all of these distilled spirits. And now you've given that energy and that feeling. And I think there's a certain romanticism to rum. Is there anything we haven't talked about on the podcast, this brief time together, that you want people to know about you or your books or what you're doing right now? Anything you want to share?
Oh, Lord, that's a good one. You know, one of the biggest misconceptions that I try to educate people about is it's very trendy to say, well, rum has no rules, it's unregulated. And I'm like, no, they do. You just don't know about those rules. You know, and people say that, you know, when they're saying rum has no rules, they mean like, I can't go pick up a bottle of rum and know exactly what it's going to be. Like, it might be sweetened or it might have me, you know, light or whatever. The reality is like, rum has many well-defined styles, and it's just confusing. If you don't understand those when you come in, you can be like, this is, you know, I don't understand this the way I could understand bourbon or Scotch whiskey. So, you know, one of the things I'm very proud of in the book, it'll probably be the least read chapter, but there's a whole chapter of like, here's all the rules of rum. Here's what defines what the government of, say, Cuba defined Cuban rum is, and the government of Jamaica has defined what Jamaican rum is. Like, these things are out there. So, yeah, in terms of my work, I would say stay tuned. Like Wonk Press, our little publishing company, we did Minimalist Tiki just to prove we could do it. Modern Caribbean Rum was sort of why we wanted to do this in the first place, this sort of ultimate rum book. We're also working with other passionate authors to bring their work out into the world. So Polynesiacs, our third book. Tom, our good friend Tiki Tom, who toured bars during COVID, home Tiki bars during COVID, and has beautiful photography, beautiful stories about all these people who make these incredibly elaborate Hope Tiki bars. And that probably never would have been published by a normal publisher. But we're like, we love this idea. We know people will buy this book. And it's been our fastest selling ever. So we have that one. We have another one coming out I can't talk about yet. But I'm working on another rum book, a more narrow topic. We have, you know, I'm very not just excited about rum and what I'm doing in that space, but also just starting, you know, having a little publishing company to bring wonky topics to life for people like you who love those topics.
Matt, thank you so much for your time today. We're grateful that you took the opportunity to sit down with us. Thanks for being a friend of Fermented Adventure. And we're going to look at that wonk press for these new books, new opportunities to where you get to tell other people's stories. And I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, Matt.
Take care.